Hello, this is WPS1. You're listening at www.wps1.org. This is Art Radio, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate. My name is Zephyr Thrall. The show you're listening to is Frank Prattle. We have two very special guests today here in San Francisco, California. It's a gorgeous day outside, and we're here at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. We have Ken Foster, the executive director of Yerba Buena. Hi.
Good morning, Zephyr.
Morning. And we have Kate Eilertsen, the interim director of visual arts. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Maybe we can just start out a brief introduction of who you guys are and what it is that you do.
Great. So I'm Ken, and I'm the executive director here. I've been here since October of 2003, so it's been just a little over 4 years. I presume your listeners know, but in case they don't, YBCA is a multidisciplinary institution. We have performing arts, visual arts, film and video, exhibitions, public programs, performances, on-site, increasingly off-site and virtual and all of that. We only do contemporary work, so we like to say that our artists are living artists, what we're interested in. My background is in performing arts primarily, so it's been pretty exciting for me to come here to this institution, which has such a strong visual arts history and such a strong visual arts presence in the Bay Area and I think in the country for that matter. So that's been very exciting for me to work with people like Kate, initially working with her in a variety of different ways before she became the interim director of visual arts, and now working very specifically with her as the interim director of visual arts. So.
Sounds great. Kate, yourself?
I have been at Yerba Buena Center now for about a month, and I came here from the Museum of Craft and Folk Art, where I was the director. As Ken said, I've been colleagues and friends with him for several years. We've worked on projects together, and I'm thrilled to be working here because I think the center does such a fantastic job of working with contemporary artists in all of the disciplines that Ken just mentioned.
Okay. So maybe just to start out the conversation, you mentioned that you just now came over, a month, so it's very, very fresh, very new.
Mm-hmm.
How are you finding Yerba Buena as far as getting your grounding, getting your feet under you? Is it an institution that you feel you can expand upon in a kind of fresh and new way, I would say, and add your voice?
Well, because I'm the interim director of visual arts, I'm working with Ken on a search for the full-time director of visual arts, so that's one of the many projects that I'm working on. I'm also, they have planned out exhibitions for the next couple of years, obviously, so I'm not, the only exhibition I'm co-curating is the Bay Area Now exhibition, which is next summer.
Okay.
So the exhibitions are exciting, and it's working with live, thinking, brilliant artists, and could there be a better job in the world? I don't think so.
Well, let me just jump in and say that Rene de Guzman was the director of visual arts, and he left about a month ago to accept a position at the Oakland Museum of California as the senior curator there, which, Rene had been here for 15 years. We were very enthusiastic and excited for him. He gets to manage a collection, build and manage a collection, which is something he could never do at YBCA. We don't collect. We do rotating exhibitions. We present exhibitions, but we don't collect. So one of my interests in seeking out Kate and asking her to take this position on is that the hire for the permanent position is huge. This is the first time in 15 years that this position has been open. We're anticipating a lot of interest nationally and internationally. This is a search that's going to take some time. And in the meantime, as Kate indicated, we have a pretty robust, complicated program. And as wonderful as the staff are that are here in the visual arts area, and they are quite wonderful, the opportunity to have someone of Kate's stature to come in and provide direction and to provide the continuity that we need is crucial. And I think she's being very kind about not indicating that she's kind of stepped into a big, complicated organization. I mean, there's just no other way to say it. It's complex on many levels. It's artistically complex. It's managerially complex. It's structurally complex. Our relationship to the community is complex. Our relationship to artists is complicated. I mean, it's not an easy thing to just come in and sort of, let things roll out as they've been set up. No matter how much advanced planning that Renee or any of us have done, the reality is that getting these projects done and up and running is a tough job. And, you know, she has a really tough job to try to kind of get that fast.
Right.
She's only going to be here for a short-ish amount of time.
Is there any guess as far as how long your guys' search is, or just until you find the right fit?
I told her it was open-ended. You know, this is November, middle of November. We've just now got the job announcement out in various places. I've gotten a couple resumes and a couple phone calls. We've been talking to a lot of people. My guess is that we're going to collect resumes and interest between now and the end of the year, and then probably in January we'll start, you know, zeroing in on who we're really interested in. That in itself, but with interviews and everything, will take, you know, 2 to 3 months.
Right.
If we hire somebody who's, you know, as we anticipate hiring somebody who's already gainfully employed in some, you know, important position somewhere, they're not going to walk away from that in 2 weeks. They're going to want to give X amount of notice, at least a month, maybe longer. You know, it could be as late as July of 08 before we actually get somebody on. Just because my experience with these kinds of searches is that they always take a lot longer than we think they will. And so I'm really grateful, you know, on so many levels. Obviously, as Kate indicated, we, you know, worked together on a variety of things over the last few years, and she's been buddy and pal, and very helpful to me. As I said, my background is not in visual arts. So as I've, you know, worked my way through understanding the visual arts world and how that works, and working with artists in that world and curators and so forth, she's been a great sort of, you know, kitchen cabinet, behind the scenes advisor, guidance for me. So that she was available and willing to take this on was like manna from heaven from my perspective. You know, I know we'll all get tired of our Mutual Admiration Society here. But
that's true. The fact is,
it's, you know, we're just blessed. You know, Kate feels she's obviously happy to be here, but let me just say, I'm thrilled that she's here.
Excellent.
I think Ken said something I'd like to pick up on, which is very true. This organization is complex, and the city or the Bay Area is complex in its art world. And so to be here and to be inside the machine working with artists, arts organizations, schools, people all over this city to kind of bring them here and help them understand that complexity and to help work with them to really build the reputation here is really challenging and exciting.
Yeah. Maybe we can go into a little bit of your guys' history and how it is that you met each other. I mean, was it because your museums are so close to each other, or did you meet each other at a party?
Originally, our museums were not so close to each other. In fact, one of the things that Kate accomplished when she's at the Museum of Craft and Folk Art was to move that institution out of Fort Mason and down into Yerba Buena Lane. We met because we were doing a project with around our youth program, and we were working with James Cass from Youth Speaks, and he put together this sort of advisory group to give us. This is very early in my time here, like within the first 6 months.
I was still at the Art Institute at that time.
That's right.
Associate dean and director of community engagement at the Art Institute, San Francisco Art Institute.
Right.
So.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. I've forgotten that. And so he pulled these people together, and we had this great meeting, and I was just hot damn impressed by this woman.
And then we had lunch.
We had lunch.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing about my job and her job when you're the director of the institution, you actually have so few peers and colleagues that you can actually talk to. Mm-hmm. You're sort of direct peers. Your relationship is vexed in many ways. You're collaborative, you're competitive. We don't all necessarily like to share the really tough stuff, like that exhibition's not working, audiences are not coming, I've got this huge problem with my development department can't figure out, and we just lost a bit. You know, you don't share those things, so you're very alone. You obviously don't share this with your staff, your feelings or your worries and anxieties about that. So to have a colleague like that is extraordinary.
Yeah, I think it's a very lonely job. You know, you really have problems that you lose sleep over every night, and you can't talk to him, and your partner gets tired of hearing about
it.
So.
Right. I definitely imagine.
So, you know, we would have lunch and call it our therapy session.
Yeah.
So how has that dynamic, though, changed now that you guys are actually working together then? Do you find that it's still, you know, fairly tight relationship?
I think we have mutual respect for each other and trust.
The other thing that I think is there's been even immediately in the last few weeks, we've been in these meetings. There's a, I don't know how to describe it, an unspoken, like, we'll like know we're on the same page and we'll both articulate it without having had a pre-meeting in which we say, you know, this is our point of view. And I'll say, well, I'm feeling like blah, blah, blah. And Kate will be like picking that up, or she'll say, I'm thinking da da da. We just had a big meeting yesterday where, you know, there was a particular part of that that became very a little bit sensitive, and she just moved right in and took exactly. And I was sitting there thinking, God, that's why I love this woman, because she was just like completely, you know, in a way that I often can't or don't, right? Which is right. The other thing about our personalities are different, our backgrounds are different, and so that complementary nature, that's really kind of cool.
And so one question I had for you, and specifically Ken, but feel free to jump in as well, Kate, is your background in performance, do you feel that that has kind of changed the character somewhat, or maybe the focus of your Buena Center for the Arts? Do you guys tend to put more in towards performance, or, I mean, you know?
Yes, there are many people that believe I'm out to destroy the visual arts program, and the performing arts program is ascendant and will rise and dominate, and it will be the end of visual arts ed. You know, I'm saying that half facetiously, but only half facetiously. You know, I'm an outsider, so you come in as an outsider into this community. So all the performance people think the first thing I'm going to do is kick out all the Bay Area artists and bring in outside performances, because that's what I've done in the rest of my career is a presenter, right? I bring in art from all over the world. So, right. Oh, well, there's not going to be no more room for Bay Area artists. Then the visual arts people think all the money is going to go to the performance, the visual arts is going to diminish, there isn't going to be attention paid to it, blah, 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 you know. You know, I sort of vacillate, to be honest with you. I vacillate on my response to that in the sense, you know, on the one hand, I want to say, okay, I understand your concerns. I understand your worries. Let me address those. And on the other hand, I'm like, what do you take me for? I am the director of the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. I came here because it was multidisciplinary. What possible purpose would it serve me to diminish the visual arts program? It is true that the performing arts program here was virtually non-existent when I came here. And it is true that in 4 years, I have worked really hard to make it a prominent program. And I'm happy to say that it's been it's been immensely successful, as I felt quite sure that it would be, despite all kinds of people telling me that it wouldn't. So in that respect, is there some, because of the vagaries of, you know, public relations or whatever, public perception, is there more attention to the performing arts program than there has been before? Yeah, there certainly is, and I'm very happy about that. And then you do kind of position that against, again, a visual arts program that's had, you know, essentially the same direction for 15 years, you know, without making any comment about the curators themselves, both Rennie and Renee, who I think are wonderful curators, but people, the public, kind of tire after a while of one vision. I mean, I can't be here for 15 years and expect it to be as dynamic a place as it is right now. At a certain moment, I'm going to have to go. Somebody else is going to have to come in and re-energize the place. That's just the way things work.
Yeah.
So those two things coming together, I think, has somewhat created perhaps a situation where people think, oh, the visual arts is receding. It's because he's putting all this energy into performing arts, and it's, you know, da-da-da-da. But I also think this, you know, Kate's going to do this remarkable bridging job, and then we're going to bring in a new vision that is going to, I think, you know, you'll start to see that dynamic shift a little bit. And we've got a film program that's, you know, one of the best kept secrets in the city.
I've definitely been to a few. It's fantastic. Zidane, it's great.
Zidane, and this weekend, this Red State Cinemas, this Phil Chambliss from Arkansas is coming here to do these films.
A folk art filmmaker.
Yeah.
Ooh. Yeah. have to say something, though, about in response to Ken there. You know, I think a leader of a center for the arts in a major city has to have a vision. He has to believe in his vision. And I think Ken has seen his vision through in the last 4 years in performing arts. I mean, it will continue to be seen through and evolve. But I've been fascinated to see how the reputation of the center really has changed around the performing arts. And I believe he has the same vision for the visual arts, that it's going to open up areas that I don't even know what they are. But I do think that he is totally committed to bringing the visual arts program into an international, highly regarded series.
Similar to that, though, I think an idea that I really look for when I look at an ICA or, you know, a MOCA or, you know, mm-hmm. your Buena Center for the Arts is really to look for a cohesion in programming between their different branches.
Mm-hmm, right.
And that's something that I maybe wanted to talk to you guys about. How much do you try to orchestrate, you know, what's happening in the main visual arts galleries with the film, with the performance, with your social outreach?
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the issues when I interviewed for this job that the board asked me about very specifically, because they felt very frustrated that was not occurring. That the what in our strategic plan we call maximizing the interdisciplinary potential of YBCA.
Oh, that's a big one.
Isn't that nice? hasn't been accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
We had three separate programs of various strengths and weaknesses, each one of them. They were all doing their own thing, and they didn't seem to cohere. And you talk to people, still to this day, no magic has yet been worked, but, you know, oh, the Yerba Buena, it's that theater, right? Oh, it's those galleries, right? There's a theater. I literally have people say, is the theater part of that? I thought it was just that one building. What about those gardens? Blah, blah, blah. So we've attacked that so that's become my, as Kate said, you know, not just a vision, but a, you know, an imperative to move quickly to do that, which is not an easy thing to do. And we've done it on a variety of fronts. We've certainly done it through the branding. I hate using that word, but it's what we're doing, the branding and the marketing, the logo redesign, all of that kind of stuff. But right from the get-go, I said, we are going to curate according to ideas. So the curators are going to sit in a room and talk about what are artists doing work on, and do we see common threads around that work, and can we pull all of the work together around those particular thematics and contextualize that for our audiences, so our audiences begin to see that there is a relationship between visual arts and performing arts and film and video. And, you know, artists are crossing those boundaries and have been for years. This is not new news. Yet institutions and curators are stuck in their, you know, I'm a performing arts
person. In their
history. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's very hard. It was very hard. The curatorial staff is better, but initially it was a huge struggle. And the first thing that comes up is, you know, well, we all work on different time frames. That can't work. Visual arts has to, you know, exhibitions are planned 2 years out. Performing arts works about a year out. Film makes their decisions 6 months. How can we possibly do that? What about our autonomy? I want my curatorial autonomy. I don't want to lose that. I don't want to be told that I have to go out and find work around politics. What if I'm not interested in politics? You know, conversely, what if I find this fabulous artist doing amazing work and there's no place for it?
Right, doesn't fit.
Doesn't fit, because we've decided we're going to do these three themes this year, and this was outside of that theme. So, like so many things since I've come to Yerba Buena, I had to just, like, hold on to the idea, because I knew it was where we needed to go, and I just had to keep gently but firmly, and sometimes not so gently, and always very firmly, just keep pushing in that direction and saying, well, let's try this, well, let's try that, let's try this, let's look at that. Well, what do you know? It looks like all that stuff does come together, and this year, amazingly, and I'm telling you, this is completely fortuitous, it fell into time chunks. This was, you know, so that we have one theme that's running sort of in this fall, and then we have another one that starts up in January, and we have another one that starts up in March, and all of the work in that time period is around this particular thematic. We can't do that every year because of the vagaries of scheduling artists and performances and films and stuff like that, but this year it did work. So what's interesting to me is that people are beginning to get that about us. You know, changing that kind of a dynamic about an institution is very tricky, but people are beginning to get that,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah. Kate, yourself, is as far as, you know, coming from the Museum of Craft and Folk Art and coming here, do you have some sort of a vision that you, I mean, obviously it's only going to be for a short time, or so. So Ken says, we'll see how long.
Yeah, we'll see how long the search fails. I need you to stay on for another year.
But do you have some kind of, you know, connecting vision between them that you would like to see play it out? Because in the Museum of Craft and Folk Art, correct me if I'm wrong, but it tends to have one solid focus, no?
Well, it had a variety of focuses with Craft and Folk Art. I wanted to speak for a minute, too, though, about the difference between working in a small museum with a staff of five and working in a large institution with a staff of 80, something like that. More than the staff, though, the resources that can make these ideas, as Ken's talking about, happen. There is a huge, 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 profound difference. And I think it's terribly sad, because I think small organizations like the Museum of Craft and Folk Art, New Langton, Intersection for the Arts, all do very, very important work, but it's getting harder and harder and harder for them to survive because the resources of these bigger institutions are just taking the money away, or not taking it away purposefully, but it's just getting more and more difficult.
If there's they're limited pie.
Yeah. But the question was about my vision for while I'm here. I think the word bridge, you know, I really do feel like I'm providing a bridge between the past 15 years and what the visual arts program was doing to what will be next. So that's as far as my vision goes.
You know, I think Kate brings up a really interesting point about small organizations that I think is really important, and it's a tough one for our time. Because I completely agree, the kind of work that is done at places like the Museum of Craft and Folk Art and at Intersection for the Arts
Southern
and Southern Exposure,
yes,
and New Langton and places like that. Is
which, just to give the listeners some background here, San Francisco has a huge amount of nonprofit activity happening with many, many organizations. I mean, as of camera work, things along those lines.
Right.
So alternative arts organizations.
Yeah, right. Very robust.
And very vital to our artistic and cultural health. Vital,
yes.
And I think it's, I mean, this isn't new news, I guess, because it's probably been this way for so long, but the bigger the institution, the more access to the power and resources that you have. Now, I like to say it's just a matter of how many zeros I have to worry about. Then, you know, the stress is the same. And in some cases, I think the stress is even larger. The larger the institution, the more money you're responsible for, the more you start having to make decisions based on what's going to generate some revenue, because you've got, you know, instead of five people that are counting on you for a living, you've got 50 people, or you've got 500 people who are counting on you for their life. And so you become more, the bigger the institution, that you become, the less adventurous you become, and the more sort of solid you are, and the more sort of somewhat, you know, maybe not conservative,
hedge the bets a little.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't know if that's gonna, you know, because we got to make X people have got to come through here and have got to pay their, and then you're like, they've got to pay their $10, or, you know, MoMA in New York, their $20 to get into the museum. It's so. But at the same time, you know, the big foundations, the big governmental support, the big money goes those institutions. The big donors, the people in our society who tend to want it to go to something that they can feel like they get what it is. I know what an opera is. I know what the Museum of Modern Art is. I know what the DeYoung Museum is. The Intersection for the Arts, it's a little wanky thing down in the Mission. It's great that you guys are doing that, and there's and we even get that as a kind of a mid-sized institution. I always say we either get the best or the worst of both of those worlds, depending on your point of view. Right. But the thing is, unless Intersection and New Langton and Southern Exposure and our places like that are fomenting that kind of activity, you know, at the end of the day, what's going to come to the larger institutions is the same old over and over and over again. Right. You know.
Well, and one of the reasons I'm here is that I think this institution is trying to bring in and is successfully bringing in some of the work that's coming right out of those smaller institutions.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Bay Area Now is a good example,
how
we are going to work with several off-site locations this year for Bay Area Now, such as Southern Exposure and the Luggage Store and Intersection, and work with them to do off-site exhibitions that are related to Bay Area Now.
Fantastic. Maybe, you know, for those listening, Bay Area Now is really the sampler of what artists in the Bay Area are doing now, as it states, you know, and is really considered the cream of the crop for the Bay Area. And, you know, I know from an artist perspective, a very, you know, prestigious position to occupy. What's your guys' vision for this Bay Area now? How's it shaping up? As you both pointed at each other.
Well, it's terrifying because it does hold a lot of importance to the Bay Area arts community. So you have to really do your homework in order to get the right stuff here. But I think this year it's shifting in several ways. One is that the institution, we are working collaboratively with each other, the performing arts, the film, and the visual arts, to all curate exhibitions and programs that will be part of Bay Area Now. So it's, I've always considered it just visual arts, but it's much more than that this year. And we're also working off four themes, which maybe I'll let Ken go through the four themes, because they've come out of the, well, we can do it together, but they've come out of these curatorial, you know, brainstorms of something that we can all hold on to keep the exhibition clear about what our big ideas are around it.
I'll pitch the four themes back to you, but I wanted to double back for just a minute to say, we started this conversation by asking the question about whether or not this exhibition had any relevance any longer. Was there a reason to do a Bay Area Now? It started out as a, you know, emerging artist that nobody was getting any attention paid to back, you know, 15 years ago or whatever when the first one was done. And it was groundbreaking. The first one was groundbreaking. It was like, oh my God, we had no idea these artists were so, who are so amazing, were doing this work in San Francisco. Well, that was 15 years ago, so lots of questions since then. Lots of those artists and ones since then have gone on to, you know, major careers, and that's wonderful, and we're all excited about that. There's a huge, as we just said, there's a huge thriving visual arts and performance and film world here. People are very much more aware of it. Collectors are buying it. Galleries are showing it. You know, it's not the same world. But the bigger issue is, like, does place matter? I mean, what does it mean? We had lots of conversation about what does it mean to be a Bay Area artist? Does that mean you actually have to live here? And if you do live here, does that affect your work at all? Like, oh, I'm a Bay Area artist, so what?
So I'm socially active, so I'm worrying about the environment and my work. You know, what does it mean?
Right, right. And what if I'm not? What if I'm a Bay Area artist? I live here in the Bay Area, but I'm not interested in any of those sort of typical Bay Area,
right,
boring old progressive ideas about environmentalism and all that stuff.
Speaking in the wake of the large oil spill.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there's that. And what about, you know, then there's the whole issue of how expensive it is to live here. Is
and really, how can artists survive in this, one of the most expensive neighborhoods in the world?
Exactly. And if I'm living here part-time and living in Berlin part-time, if my artistic practice is what takes me out of the Bay Area. It's not even the real estate, although that's probably, but maybe it's my artistic practice. I want to collaborate, as an artist, I want to collaborate with people who live in places other than the Bay Area. One of the artists we're doing this year is Shinichi Koga, who is a Bay Area artist, performing artist, is doing a piece, and his collaborators are in Taiwan and in Germany and in Seattle, and, you know, he's creating a piece using all these people, so... Is he a Bay Area artist? Or what about an artist who comes out here to go to art school? They're actually from New York. They come out here to go to art school. They graduate from CCA. They've lived here for, what, a year or 2 years or whatever. And they're doing art. Are they a Bay Area artist? How long do you have to live here before you're a Bay Area artist? What, I mean, all those questions came up, and that's how we sort of, we did then sort of start to decide, we did decide, we would examine that question. There will be artists in this exhibition and in the performance program who don't physically live in San Francisco.
Yeah, I mean, and perhaps I have an archaic view of it, but I was always under the impression that it was the mail. Like, where you get your mail is where you,
oh, that's interesting.
Where you live.
Yeah. Yeah, but of course, you know, now that we have email right, and cell phone numbers that travel with you wherever you go,
right?
You know, so so that we want to examine that idea. And what when I say there will be artists in this exhibition who are not physical residents of the Bay Area, nonetheless,
they've been touched.
Right.
Right.
Or their work examines what it means to be. So, and we're not, it's not a suddenly an international biennial.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the common thread.
But you are opening it up for a, you know, broader cosmology that way, that it's going to be expansive.
Yeah. Exactly.
Now, thankfully, Ken has just talked about two of the four themes that we have, and maybe even all four of them.
Cleverly.
It's very clever. So the first one he mentioned was place. What does it mean? The second one is people. Just because you get your mail here, does that mean you're from? We're opening both, we're blowing those two concepts that we have very conservatively held out of the water.
Right.
It's the way the world is going. The third one is ideas. What kind of ideas are fermented here in the Bay Area? And the last one is ideals. So you were here in the 60s in San Francisco. Social activism was what your cause was. Is that because it was a time of the world? Or was it what happened here in San Francisco that made you that? So you, what are the ideals working here today?
Well, what do you guys think? I mean, from an outside perspective, traveling quite a bit, as you know, fortunately I get to do, I know that that the world, how I've seen it, sees San Francisco in really two ways. You have one, the '60s ideal of you know, the hippie and the free thinker, if you will, kind of. That is definitely one opinion reserved for here. And the other is the dot-commer that San Francisco is really seen as Google. Mm-hmm. You know, the home of the home of the computer now, and it really splits along those lines. What do you guys think? When I mean, you guys travel, what do people say?
I think that's true, but I think it also becomes slightly more nuanced as you kind of dig a little deeper. One thing that was aware of before I came here and continue to be aware of since I've been here, but that those of us who live here sometimes forget, is that. As recently as this past weekend, I had an artist who lives in L.A. and works all over the world, came to town and we were having a drink together and said, it's so important what you're doing here. It's so important because it's the only place in the country where you can feel like some progressive thought or idea or something is actually happening. So, and it reminds me that for all of, and I have as big a critique over San Francisco nostalgia, which is just, just burdensome over Haight Street and hippies and you know, cable cars, and I left my heart.
Although I love cable cars.
I love all that stuff, but like I just don't want to be burdened with it all the time. But the rest of the country still looks here and says, this is where. This is the cutting edge. This is the.
If it can't happen here,
it can't happen
where can
here.
It happen?
Right, exactly. I think that's vitally important, particularly in this like unbelievably repressive age that we're living into. I think that it's that. And so, in terms of ideals, you know, that one of those four ideas, I think the ideals is a really important one, and to see if the contemporary artists that we see are thinking about that in ways other than, you know, 60s liberalism that is, you know, really nostalgia.
Right. One question that I have for you guys, and kind of to switch gears here, is, I mean, it's a fairly rare opportunity to get two executive directors, you know, although, Kate, you're kind of shifting roles here, but to get two executive directors in the same room to talk about issues. And one question that I've always wondered is how much of an executive director's time is really spent babysitting? Is really spent, you know, kind of, you know, fire maintenance as far as staff is concerned. What do you guys think?
I think
it's a long pause.
Yeah. Got to choose words carefully yeah. here.
I think if you're going to be an executive director, you have to reckon with the idea that your range of responsibility is so vast mm-hmm. that the particular passion that brought you into it in the first place, the art, will take an increasingly smaller portion of your time. And at some moment, and I think it differs for all of us, where and when that moment is, at some moment you have to decide, you know what, this is not what I signed on for. Mm-hmm. This is not feeding my life, and I've got to do something about it. Or, this is great, I'm very happy. There's some aspects of curatorial work in the performing arts that I've done for 25 years that I'm really happy not to be doing. Really happy. I have an associate curator who is phenomenal. She's Angela Maddox is this brilliant young woman in the field. She provides me with great energy and enthusiasm and new ideas and really charges me up, and she also does the work. So, I'm very happy not to be doing that. But I also have my moments where I just think my day is a series of meetings. And on my good days, I'll say it's great that, I go from having a discussion about art to having a discussion about the HVAC system and what's wrong with it and why are the doors not locking and what about this particular employee who's having this problem or this other employee who's having this big problem or or the budget and now what are we going to do about that and this grant we thought was coming is not. Now, some days I think that's great and some days I just want it all to stop. And I just want to go away and mm-hmm. and I think we and our the people that supervise us and the people who look at us forget what we
why
need
why we came here
why we came here mm-hmm. right and what we need to keep doing this mm-hmm. and that does mean I cannot be immersed in a minutia every single day
mm-hmm.
day
after right day. Right.
I'll be honest and say I made the decision to come here because I was really tired of worrying about money, of managing finance committees and executive committees and all the things that I when I chose to go into the arts, was not interested in at all. And here I was spending 60 hours a week doing it.
Right.
People keep asking me what I'm going to do. You know what? I don't know. I don't think I'll be an executive director again. I might change in the next 9 months, but I honestly don't know because too little of my time was spent doing what I love and what I got into the field to do.
Right, which is primarily curation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's, one thing that I think that I always wonder about people in the high profile, in the high pressure job such as you both have, is how you fight that burnout. I mean, burnout is inevitable in any field. If you do something hard enough, long enough, then it will crush you.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you guys combat that? I mean, obviously one way is to switch jobs, but
switch jobs. Well, I mean this. Honestly, this is my fifth job or something in my career. The longest I've been in one position is 9 years. My last position, I was there for 9 years. The one before that, I was 7 years. The two before that was 2 years each, 2.5 years each. I do think there's an arc to your time. I said earlier in this interview, the time is going to come where I'll need to go. I can't be here for, I don't even want to tell you how old I'm going to be in 15 years, I just think you run your course. And you move on.
What about on a daily basis, though? Things that you guys, engage into. I mean, first of all, how much do you work?
At the Museum of Craft and Folk Art, I was working way too much. an average of 10 hours a day, but it was 7 days a week.
So
I did burn out.
Right.
It's true, I did burn out. Things I do are go for a walk every morning for half an hour or 45 minutes or something. I always take a break in the middle of the day and get outside of the building because I think it's really important to get some fresh air and get away from it. And I always come back with new ideas about something I was working on. And, frankly, to go see an exhibition or an artist that I'm interested in, that's the real soul food.
Yeah.
That's really true. I just came back from a couple of weeks ago. I went to New York for 3 or 4 days. As it happened, I had a window in my calendar, amazingly, and I said, I haven't been to New York since January. I need to go. And it's the height of the season, lots of stuff. So I went and got renewed in some ways, because I saw some really, really great art. Like, really great art. Some of it, the Kara Walker show at the Whitney, was so disturbing to me that I was telling Kate afterwards, I sort of walked out of there and kind of wandered around aimlessly in the Upper East Side for a while. I had no idea where I was going. I wasn't going anywhere or what I wanted. I just didn't know what to do next. You know, it was, for about an hour, I just sort of aimlessly wandered around and eventually sat down and had an espresso somewhere. That is an unbelievable experience. So certainly to do that, and that's so energizing to, like, okay, yeah, right, this is why I got into this job. On a more daily basis, a lot of the things that Kate said, my staff knows that I go to the gym and work out every single day at noon, and you cannot impinge on that time. You cannot. My secretary arranges my calendar to enable me to have my gym time every day. And some of it is the ritual of walking over there, getting on the Precor, listening to my iPod, whatever. Sometimes I, solve problems while I'm there. Sometimes I don't. I just, like, enjoy the music. I love to go, my partner and I love to go hiking in Marin. I'm one of those people, I had a therapist one time telling me that, I'm the kind of person who stands on a cliff like that and looks out at the ocean and feels exhilarated and enthusiastic, and there are other people who find that quite terrifying. Right. But for me, and my partner always gets annoyed because I'm like always insisting that we take the coastal hikes because I want to see the ocean. I want that big vista. I don't want to go down in the woods. I want to. Yeah. There's something about that that works on me kind of spiritually. And I also have really shameful pleasures. Broadway show tunes. I absolutely love cheesy pop culture that I can that I get all weepy about Les Mis or something stupid like that, which I don't know, I think is just allowing me to access some emotional stuff that I keep pretty tightly under control.
I definitely have my guilty pleasures as well. You're not alone.
and what are yours?
Boy George came on the other day while I was walking around, and I found myself singing and doing a little dance. And then I kind of checked myself and kind of got it back under control there because I was in public.
Yeah, exactly.
Kate, yourself, guilty pleasure, now that we're all confessing.
Now we're confessing.
I love to go to movies. Hollywood movies. I see at least a movie a week.
Awesome. Good.
And I like to go to a big dark theater. I don't like to watch it on a television.
Right.
I love to be all by myself in a big theater.
Yeah. Well, excellent. Well, I think that about wraps it up. Thank you guys both so much.
Thank you.
This is WPS1 Art Radio, PS1 and PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate. My name is Jeffrey Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle. My special guests today have been Ken Foster, the Executive Director of Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, and Kate Eilertson, the Interim Director of Visual Arts here at Yerba Buena as well. Thank you guys both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.